I'm Christopher Lydon with an epic poet of the us, Joan Houlihan. We're taking the many pulses of poetry in our midst, in our time, on Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one falls in a series, Whose Words These Are, on the way to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival in October 09. We're asking, as if for the first time, where poetry comes from and where it's going. Teacher, writer, and critic Joan Houlihan founded the Concord Poetry Center outside Boston in the hometown of the American Renaissance of the 1850s, Emerson's town, and Thoreau's, and Louisa May Alcott's town of Concord. Their old idea of a poetry circle is reborn, but linked today, of course, on a global scale by the World Wide Web. We met Joan Houlihan in the Cambridge haunt of New England poets, the Grolier Bookshop in Harvard Square. Joan Houlihan, introduce yourself. There must have been a poem or a poet that got you into the game.
Well, probably everybody's trigger poem was The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I've seen that through in lots of poets' bios as being the poem, and that was a big one for me. But what really sealed it for me was the studying Gerard Manley Hopkins. Having had a strict Catholic background, going through parochial school, going through all of that kind of, in many ways, poetic learning, because all of it turned into a kind of ritual and song and psalm and parable and story, and was all very useful later, after the religion part. I was very intrigued by Gerard Manley Hopkins, how someone so talented, you know, with such a voice, could also be a priest, and how that related, and how that puzzle began to interest me. But I was drawn first by the power of his voice and the power of the music. So I'm very interested in the ear and the sound. I'm in my own poetry. I'm very interested in the sonic textures of all poems. So his is the perfect example of someone who uses sound.
Dappled things, yeah, and all that, yeah, good stuff. So place yourself in the great chain of being in poetry. How many degrees of separation from the biggies like Hopkins?
Oh.
And how many others?
Oh, well, those are my heroes.
Who else?
Hopkins, Eliot, certainly Sylvia Plath, who I think has been overshadowed for so long by her biography, has yet really to emerge from that for the consummate poet she was. In fact, I think probably Emily Dickinson and Sylvia Plath for female poets, huge, huge influences for me. Mm. And also both giving me, as a female, a way to look at being part of that poetry pantheon. Because up until then, you know, through high school and reading very prescribed kinds of literature in parochial school, it was male-oriented. And also oriented toward an academic kind of life. In other words, something that I saw as not related to me.
So would you give us an all-time favorite poem, not your own?
Well, I have a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem that I consider a favorite poem.
Please.
I would love to read that. It's called No Worst, There Is None. No worst, there is none. Pitched past pitch of grief. More pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. Comforter, where is your comforting? Mary, mother of us, where is your relief? My cries heave herds long, huddle in a mane, a chief woe, world sorrow, on an age-old anvil, wince and sing. Then lull, then leave off. Fury had shrieked, no lingering, let me be fell. Force, I must be brief. Oh, the mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, may you who never hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort, it serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep. So I love the force of that and the emotional power behind it. Nowadays, I think it would be seen as really over the top, and I love it for that. I love that over the top quality of it, and I love the drama of it. I think poetry, in some cases, lacks drama.
Joan, would you give us a taste of your favorite Dickinson?
Yeah, sure, I'll be glad to. This is called After Great Pain, A Formal Feeling Comes. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The stiff heart questions, was it he that bore, and yesterday, or centuries before? The feet mechanical go round a wooden way of ground or air or aught. Regardless, grown a quartz contentment like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow, first chill, then stupor, then the letting go.
What a masterpiece.
It really is. And the psychological exactitude, I guess you could say, about this is really remarkable to me.
While we're up, a little Sylvia Plath.
Sylvia Plath.
The great poet hidden behind the biography.
This is one of my favorites because it's so, in some ways, about the ordinary, which we don't usually think of Sylvia Plath connected this way. This is about her child. Morning song. Love set you going like a fat gold watch. The midwife slapped your footsoles, and your bald cry took its place among the elements. Our voices echo, magnifying your arrival. New statue in a drafty museum. Your nakedness shadows our safety. We stand round blankly as walls. I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand. All night your moth breath flickers among the flat pink roses. I wake to listen. A far sea moves in my ear. One cry and I stumble from bed, cow heavy and floral in my Victorian nightgown. Your mouth opens, clean as a cat's. The window square whitens and swallows its dull stars. And now you try your handful of notes. The clear vowels rise like balloons.
Would you give us the short course in your own work?
Short course in my own work. Sure. My latest book is called The Us. And
not the to be confused with the U.S.
Not to be confused with the U.S., I hope, although some will. And it's a collective voice. In fact, that's the name of the group of speakers, The Us. They speak as one, something like a chorus. They are nomadic hunter-gatherers. They are moving and wandering and looking to survive from one place to another. They are unnamed, but probably primitive. Their language is understandable, but unusually, I would say, fractured, perhaps, or seeming to be formed. So linguistically, they're not quite sophisticated. Psychologically, they are not either, but in their lack of sophistication, I think they speak. They speak to us in a contemporary way because I've tried to strip back all of the strivings that seem to engulf everyone now and go to what I think of as basic human needs and desires.
I'm dying to hear them.
Okay. So there's a plot in this story, and I should say something about that. There's a handful of characters, if you will, the father, the son, the wife, the Bray, which is a child. There is another group of people called Thems, and they are more sophisticated, and they are more interested in enslaving the us and having them do things for them. So, of course, they avoid them. So there's this kind of clash of civilizations. It's a big theme, but these are very, in some ways, also small and understandable concerns. What do I eat? Where do I go? Where do I sleep? So I'll read one from the very beginning to get so you have a sense of who they are and what they're about. This is called Morning and His Son is Born. Morning and his son is born from dark. Our father took the track to where the red deer ran, except one stood, great-headed, tall, of a size and look to put in mind the reach of what us were and came to be, and how us were the smaller. What formed him's elk head godly, as from an inner body, bone branched, notched, and wide, spread and sprouted out and up, and him, on a standing, watchful and seen, ran the forest, head struck and stuck between the trees. Our stick sharp for the kill, lifted high, in, and from him's throat a groan went, leg bent, knelt. Then all of him were loosed and spread in large and streaming breath, our stick holes streaming red. This book is very different from the books preceding it. So you asked about my life or trajectory or as a poet, the short course in Houlihan, I guess, hooliganism, as it were. The book previous to this was The Mending Worm, and that was much more personal, kind of biographical. You know, all poets want to use their biography. That's what we have. That's our material. Write what you know and so forth. But at some point, and I've reached that point, you're tired of it. And that's not of interest, and it doesn't have the emblematic quality that it once had. And so I've reached out to encompass other characters, other figures that are speaking for me.
Us begins to sound like a very public epic.
Yes, it is. It's definitely in the vein of epic, although I wouldn't want to make such claims. I maybe epic with a small e.
I made it for you.
So. Thank you.
Give us your own sort of off-the-top report on the state of the art.
I would say there's a lot more searching going on, or at least it's more evident than it used to be. Certainly when I was in graduate school and reading, the anthology of poets, I didn't have a sense that I have now of all these various pieces. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pieces. It's somewhat balkanized, and there are people trying to form schools. So this is to make it more sensible to have this school and to have that school, to have, for example, the elliptical poets. Once there's a label, then people feel a little more comfortable mm-hmm. that we understand this piece of it and we understand that piece of it. But for a reader going into a bookstore and pulling down a book of poetry, they could try five times and come up with, you know, five very different, completely different ways of approaching the art. The Best American Poetry every year shows that kind of wide variety, eclecticism.
Let me ask you, though, Joan, to whom do you address your poetry? Is it for yourself, your readers, mm-hmm. your editors, mm-hmm. your kids, mm-hmm. a spoken audience or a book audience or what? Who are you talking to? Who do you want to talk to?
Not to, again, make a grand claim, but I feel like I want to speak to time. I want to say something that speaks to the time that we're in and the time where we've been, and that the voice that I want people to hear will be one that they can hear forever. Now, that's a very grand claim, I know, but...
Why not? When we meet 5 years from now, Joan, what will we say about the world of poetry?
Well, I mean, to think about that, I think we need to think about the business side of it and where publishing is right now and how the poetry is being disseminated. I mean, it's not so much where will we be aesthetically. I think where will we be at all in terms of how will people access these poems? How will... publishing industry is struggling. The independent publishers, I mean, they're always struggling. I have a manuscript conference I run about once a month, and editors and publishers come there and they evaluate people's manuscripts for potential publication. But they're always talking about their struggle and about how they can barely exist because poetry books Many are being produced, few are being sold. The publishing industry as a whole is suffering. The digitization of literature is happening at the same time. And so I think in 5 years, our conversation might have to do with how do you get your poetry out in the world now, who is your readership now?
What do you learn from schools and from particularly kids in high school about the medium?
Well, I don't teach in high school. I teach in two MFA programs, one at Lesley University in Cambridge and now one at Columbia University in New York. And I'm learning from the students that the drive to be a poet is there. It's a very primal drive. It really seems to have nothing to do with what's going on in the world at large. However, the way that students now approach poetry is very different from when I was in school. There's an approach that has to do more with how will my words be seen, when will they be seen. There's no doubt about what I'm doing, really. It was such a struggle for me to even call myself a poet. I'm a little daunted by the fact that there are so many young people who just laid claim to that identity, and now what's next? Now how do I do that? Mm. So that's an interesting thing. But I think what you're asking about is what the view is from young people about the art and whether or not they're interested in it. And I think they are, but I think they're interested in it in a different form. I think they're interested in song. I mean, my sons listen to records and no, they're not records, they're CDs, but the lyrics sometimes are fabulous. I mean, they're just poetry. There's
Who are your favorites?
Well, right now I like Coldplay for up-to-date artists. But I think that that's where the poetry is for younger people. And I think many young people see the books as kind of an artifact that, you know, a poem in a book as a, something of an artifact.
Joan, you're part of a Concord, Massachusetts collective of poets today, which always reminds me of Susan Cheever's line about the age of Emerson. She said, you know, most of the best American literature was written in five houses on three streets within 5 years in Concord, Massachusetts. I'd love to know about the Concord group, but also what you make of the New England tradition and the links today to Thoreau, Emerson, Dickinson, Wallace Stevens, the greats.
As you know, I started the Concord Poetry Center, and that was really that really grew out of a sense of my own need for a community of poets. Simply, I mean, I wasn't intending it more than that. Yeah, a gang, and that, you know, in that way, there's a link to the other gangs in Concord that were formed for the same reason. Where am I kin? You know, where can I go to talk about what I'm interested in, and where are the people who will appreciate that? I think there are a lot of poets outside the, say, Boston-Cambridge area who are living lives, quiet desperation or not, but they have families, they have work, but they're still writing poetry, and but they're very isolated. And I think that my idea of this was to be a place for such people and others. And as it turns out, it turns out there are a lot of poets who have the same need. So the center grew from maybe 20 people in the beginning to now it's nearly 200 members. Mm. But also more than that, there are people who come out to our events. We get 30 to 50 people every time we have a Sunday reading, and I think I don't always recognize those people. You know, it's a different set of people. So in terms of the community and the connection with Concord, I've found that Concord is a very interesting place in terms of it wanting to be both seen as a literary center, but also owning that identity. So, in other words, the Emerson umbrella, where I started the Poetry Center, is a place for artists. It's a place for painters, sculptors, potters. Nowhere in that Emerson umbrella, was there a place for poets, which I found strange, or a literary center of any kind.
And then we asked Joan Houlihan, as we've asked other poets, to fill in some of the conversational gaps with a version of the Proust questionnaire.
Who's your ideal artist, Joan Houlihan, in another medium?
Well, I tend to think of drama being next of kin to my medium. And in that, I've always had a kinship with the absurdist playwrights, Pinter and Edward Albee. Beckett was a huge influence on me, and I think on my thinking, not just his plays, but his literature.
What talent do you most love that you don't have?
I think I would like to be able to either sing or play an instrument. That would be neat.
What would you call the keynote of your personality as a poet?
Probably a need to see things as clearly and honestly as possible. I do like honesty. I do like the reality of things.
What quality do you love in a poem?
A sweeping sense of humanity, so that I get the emotional part. I love the language part that brings you to a kind of vision. I love a poem. Well, I love a great poem, like the Hopkins poem, a poem that works on so many levels that you never tire of it. But that it's not that the levels are keeping you out. It's just that they're not all visible at once. And you can revisit it and re-experience it.
What's your motto?
Be prepared. I don't know what to say.
Joan Houlihan, thank you so much. This has been fun.
Thanks.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Joan Houlihan. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern helped us get ready. Thanks to the Grolier Poetry Bookshop and the Massachusetts Poetry Festival for helping gather the players. And thank you for listening. All the more if you'll leave a comment or your poem or your favorite poem from somebody else at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden.